Chapter 6. Gregor scrubbed himself down using a sponge and some gloopy stuff he found in a bowl by the pool. He lathered his hair and even cleaned inside his ears, wanting to get every bit of Overlander smell off him. If he was going to try to escape, he needed to be as indistinguishable from his hosts as possible. On hooks by the pool hung a row of white towels. Gregor couldn't identify the thick woven fabric. "Sure not cotton," he muttered, but the towel was soft and absorbed water much better than the thin, worn ones they used at home. He walked back into the changing room, drying his hair, and found his clothes had disappeared. In their place was a neat pile of smoky blue garments, a shirt, pants, and what seemed to be underwear. They were much finer than the towels. The cloth ran silkily through his fingers. "What is this stuff?" he wondered, slipping into the shirt. He slid his feet into a pair of braided straw sandals and padded out of the changing room. Marith and Perdita were waiting. "So, what happened to my clothes?" asked Gregor. "They have been burned," said Marith apprehensively. Gregor sensed Marith was afraid he'd be mad. "It is most dangerous to keep them," said Perdita by way of explanation. "The ash carries no scent." Gregor shrugged to show he didn't care. "That's cool," he said. "These fit me fine." Marith and Perdita looked grateful. "After a few days of our food, you will be without much odor too," said Perdita encouragingly.
"That'll be nice," said Gregor dryly. These Underlanders were sure obsessed with his smell.
Dulcet emerged from the left side of the bathroom, carrying a squeaky clean boots. She had on a soft, rose-colored shirt and a clean diaper made from the same material as Gregor's bath towel. She extended her leg and pointed proudly to the new sandal on her foot.
"Sanda," she said to Gregor.
He stuck out his foot to show her his shoes.
"Me too," he said.
He assumed they'd burned Boots's clothes as well. He tried to remember what she'd been wearing in case he had to explain the missing stuff to his mom. One dirty diaper, no loss. One pair of scuffed pink sandals her feet were growing out of anyway. One stained T-shirt. It would probably be okay. Gregor didn't know exactly what he would tell his mom about the Underland. The truth would scare her to death. He'd work out something when they got back to the laundry room, but the sooner that happened, the simpler the story could be. Boots reached out her arms and Gregor took her, pressing his nose into her damp curls. She smelled fresh and a bit like the ocean.
"She is well grown," said Dulcet. "Your arms must be tired."
She went back into the changing room and came out with some kind of pack. It fitted on his back with straps, and Boots could ride in it, looking over his shoulder. He had seen people carrying kids in specially designed backpacks, but his family didn't have money for that sort of stuff.
"Thanks," he said casually, but he was secretly elated. It would be a lot easier to escape with Boots in a backpack than in his arms.
Dulcet led them up several staircases and through a maze of halls. They eventually wound up in a long room that opened out onto a balcony.
"We call this the High Hall," said Dulcet.
"I think you guys forgot the roof," said Gregor.
While the walls were decorated with the greatest care, there was nothing but the black cavern above their heads. Dulcet laughed.
"Oh no, it is meant to be so. We entertain here often, and many bats can arrive at once."
Gregor imagined the bottleneck 100 bats would cause trying to get in the door downstairs. He could see the advantage of a bigger landing strip. Vicus was waiting for them by the balcony with an older woman. Gregor guessed she might be around his grandma's age, but his grandma was stooped and moved painfully from arthritis. This woman stood very straight and looked strong.
"Gregor and Boots, the Overlanders. My wife, Solovit," said Vicus.
"Hey," said Gregor. "Nice to meet you."
But the woman stepped forward and offered both her hands to him. The gesture surprised him. No one else had made any effort to touch him since he'd landed. "Welcome, Gregor. Welcome, Boots," she said in a low, warm voice. "It is an honor to have you among us."
"Thanks," Gregor mumbled, confused because she was throwing his prisoner status off balance. She really made him feel like someone special.
"Hi, you,"
said Boots, and Solovet reached up to pat her cheek.
"Vikas tells me you are very anxious to return home. It pains me that we cannot aid you immediately, but to seek the surface tonight would be impossible," she said. "The Underland buzzes with news of your arrival. I guess everyone wants to look at us like we're freaks or something. Well, they'd better look fast," thought Gregor. But he said, "Then I'll get to see some stuff down here."
Vikas waved him over to the low wall that ringed the balcony.
"Come, come, there is much to view," he said.
Gregor joined Vikas at the wall and felt his stomach lurch. He involuntarily took a few steps backward. This balcony, it seemed, hung out over the side of the palace. Only the floor separated him from the dizzying drop.
"Do not fear. It is well built," said Vikas.
Gregor nodded but didn't move forward again. If the thing started collapsing, he wanted to be able to make it back to the high hall. "I can see fine from here," he said, and he could. Regalia was even more impressive from above. On the ground, he couldn't see that the streets, which were paved in various shades of stone, were laid out in a complex geometric pattern so that the city looked like a giant mosaic. He also hadn't realized how big the place was. It extended out several miles in each direction. "How many people live down here?" asked Gregor.
"We number 3,000 or so," said Vikas. "More if the harvest reaps well."
3,000. Gregor tried to get a mental picture of how many people that would be. His school had about 600 kids in it, so 5 times that. "So, what are you guys doing down here anyway?" asked Gregor. Vikas laughed.
"We are amazed it has taken you so long to ask." "Well, it is a marvelous tale," said Vikas, taking a deep breath to begin it.
"Once, many years ago, there lived..."
"Vikas," interrupted Solovet.
"Perhaps the tale would go well with supper." Gregor silently thanked her. He was starving, and he had a feeling Vikas wasn't the kind of guy to leave out any details. The dining room was off the high hall. A table had been set for 8. Gregor hoped Dulcet would be joining them, but after tucking Boots in a sort of high chair, she backed up several feet from the table and stood. Gregor didn't feel comfortable eating with her standing there, but he thought he might get her in trouble if he said something. Neither Vikas nor Solovet took a chair, so Gregor decided to wait too. Soon, Luxa swept into the room in a dress that was a lot fancier than the clothes she'd worn in the stadium. Her hair was loose and fell like a shiny silver sheet to her waist. She was with a guy who Gregor guessed was about 16. He was laughing at something she'd just said. Gregor recognized him from the stadium. It was the rider who'd felt cocky enough to lie down on his bat as they'd swirled around his head.
"Another show-off," thought Gregor.
But the guy gave him such a friendly look that Gregor decided not to jump to conclusions. Luxa was annoying, but most of the other Underlanders were okay. "My cousin Henry," said Luxa shortly, and Gregor wanted to laugh. Here, among all these strange names, was a Henry. Henry gave Gregor a low bow and came up, grinning. "Welcome, Overlander," he said. Then he grabbed Gregor's arm and spoke in his ear in a dramatically hushed voice.
"Beware the fish, for Luxa plans to poison you directly."
Vikas and Solovet laughed, and even Dulcet smiled. It was a joke. These people actually had a sense of humor.
"Beware your fish, Henry," returned Luxa.
I gave orders to poison scoundrels, forgetting you would be dining as well.
Henry winked at Gregor.
Switch plates with the bats, he whispered,
and at that moment two bats swooped into the room from the high hall.
Ah, the bats.
Gregor recognized the golden bat Luxa had been riding earlier. A large gray bat fluttered into a chair near Vicus, and everyone else took a seat.
Gregor the Overlander, meet you Aurora and Euripides. They are bonded to Luxa and myself, said Vicus, extending a flexed hand to the gray bat on his right.
Euripides brushed the hand with his wing. Luxa and her golden bat Aurora performed the same exchange. Gregor had thought the bats were like horses, but now he could see they were equals. Did they talk?
Greetings, Overlander, said Euripides in a soft, purring voice.
Yeah, they talked.
Gregor began to wonder if his fish dinner would want to chat as he sliced into it.
Nice to meet you, said Gregor politely.
What does that mean, that you're bonded to each other?
Soon after we arrived in the Underland, we humans formed a special alliance with the bats, said Solovet. Both sides saw the obvious advantages to joining together. But beyond our alliance, individual bats and humans may form their own union. That is called bonding.
And what do you do if you're bonded to a bat? Asked Gregor. I mean, besides play ball games together.
There was a pause in which glances were exchanged around the table.
He'd said something wrong again.
You keep each other alive, said Luxa coldly. It had seemed like he was making fun of something serious.
Oh, I didn't know, said Gregor. Of course you did not, said Solovet, shooting a look at Luxa. You have no parallel in your own land.
And do you bond with the crawlers, too? Gregor asked.
Henry snorted with laughter. I would as soon bond with a stone. At least it could be counted on not to run away in battle.
Luxa broke into a grin.
And perhaps you could throw it. I suppose you could throw a crawler.
But then I would have to touch it, said Henry, and the two cracked up.
The crawlers are not known for their fighting ability, said Vicus, by way of explanation to Gregor.
Neither he nor Solovet were laughing.
He turned to Luxa and Henry.
Yet they live on.
Perhaps when you can comprehend the reason for their longevity, you will have more respect for them.
Henry and Luxa attempted to look serious, although their eyes were still laughing.
It is of little consequence to the crawlers whether I respect them or not, said Henry lightly.
Perhaps not. But it is of great consequence whether Luxa does, or so it will be in some 5 years when she comes of age to rule, said Vicus. At that time, foolish jokes at the crawler's expense may make the difference between our existence and our annihilation. They do not need to be warriors to shift the balance of power in the Underland.
This sobered Luxa up for real, but it killed the conversation.
An awkward pause stretched into an embarrassing silence. Gregor thought he understood what Vicus had meant. The crawlers would make better friends than enemies, and humans shouldn't go around insulting them. To Gregor's relief, the food arrived, and an Underlander servant placed a half-circle of small bowls around him. At least three contained what looked like various types of mushrooms. One had a rice-like grain, and the smallest contained a handful of fresh greens. He could tell by the skimpy portion that the leafy stuff was supposed to be a big treat. A platter with a whole grilled fish was set in front of him. The fish resembled the ones Gregor was used to, except it had no eyes. He and his dad had once watched a show on TV about fish that lived way down deep in some cave and didn't have eyes either. The weird thing was that when the scientists brought some up to study in a lab, the fish had sensed the light and had grown eyes. Not right away, but in a few generations. His dad had gotten very excited over the show and had taken Gregor to the American Museum of Natural History to look for eyeless fish. They had ended up at the museum a lot, just the two of them.
His dad was crazy about science, and it seemed as if he wanted to pour everything in his brain right into Gregor's head. It was a little dangerous, because even a simple question could bring on a half-hour explanation. His grandma had always said, "Ask your daddy the time and he tells you how to make a clock." But he was so happy explaining, and Gregor was just happy being with him. Besides, Gregor had loved the rainforest exhibit and the cafeteria with French fries shaped like dinosaurs. They had never really figured out how the fish had known to grow eyes. His dad had had some theories, of course, but he couldn't explain how the fish had been able to change so fast. Gregor wondered how long it took people to become transparent with purple eyes. He turned to Vikas. "So, you were going to tell me how you got down here?" While Gregor tried not to wolf his food, which turned out to be delicious, Vikas filled him in on the history of Regalia.
Not all of it was clear, but it seemed the people had come from England in the 1600s.
"Yes, they were led here by a stonemason, one Bartholomew of Sandwich," said Vikas, and Gregor had to work to keep a straight face. He had visions of the future. He saw the Underland in a dream, and he set out to find it. Sandwich and a group of followers had sailed to New York, where he got on famously with the local tribe. The Underland was no secret to the Native Americans, who had made periodic trips below the earth for ritual purposes for hundreds of years. They had little interest in living there, and didn't care if Sandwich was mad enough to want to. "Of course, he was quite sane," said Vikas. "He knew that one day the earth would be empty of life, except what was sustained beneath the ground." Gregor thought it might be rude to tell Vikas that billions of people lived up there now. Instead, he asked, "So, everybody just packed up and moved down here?" "Heavens no. It was 50 years before the 800 were down and the gates to the overland sealed. We had to know we could feed ourselves and have walls to keep us safe. Rome was not built in a day," Vikas laughed. "That was how Fred Clark, the overlander, said it." "What happened to him?" asked Gregor, spearing a mushroom. The table got quiet. "He died," said Solovet softly. "He died without your son." Gregor lowered the mushroom to his plate. He looked over at Boots, who was covered from head to toe in some kind of mushy baby stew. She sleepily finger-painted on the stone tabletop with the gravy. "Our son," thought Gregor. Had it set? Was it bedtime? Had the police gone, or were they still there questioning his mom? If they'd gone, he knew where she'd be, sitting at the kitchen table, alone in the dark, crying. Suddenly he couldn't stand to hear another word about the Underland. He just had to get out of it.
Chapter 7. The darkness pressed down on Gregor's eyes until he felt it had physical weight, like water. He'd never been completely without light before. At home, street lights, car headlights, and the occasional flashing fire truck shone in the tiny window of his bedroom. Here, once he'd blown out the oil lamp, it was as if he'd lost the sense of sight entirely. He'd been tempted to relight the lamp. Marith had told him that torches burned all night long in the corridor outside his room, and he could rekindle the flame there. But he wanted to save the oil. He'd be lost without it once he got out of Regalia. Boots had made a snuffling sound and pressed her back deeper into his side. His arm tightened around her. Servants had prepared separate beds for them, but Boots had climbed right in with Gregor. It hadn't been hard to get the Underlanders to excuse them for bed. Everyone could see Boots could barely keep her eyes open, and he must have looked pretty ragged himself. He wasn't. Adrenaline was pumping through him so fast, he was afraid that people could hear his heart beating through the heavy curtains that shut off their bedroom from the hall. The last thing he could do was sleep. They had been invited to bathe again before bed,
It was something of a necessity for Boots, who, in addition to stew, had conditioned her curls with some kind of pudding. Gregor hadn't objected either. The water gave him a quiet place to think out his escape plan. It also gave him a chance to ask Dulcet about the water system in the palace without seeming suspicious. "How do you guys have hot and cold running water?" he asked. She told him the water was pumped from a series of hot and cold springs. "And then it just empties back into a spring?" he asked innocently. "Oh no, that would not be fresh," said Dulcet. "The dirty water falls into the river beneath the palace and then flows to the waterway." It was just the information he needed. The river beneath the palace was their way out. Even better, it led to the waterway. He didn't know what that was exactly, but Vicus had mentioned it had two gateways to the overland. Boots stirred again in her sleep, and Gregor patted her side to quiet her. She had not seemed to miss home until bedtime, but she looked worried when he told her it was time to go to sleep.
"Mama," she asked, "Lizzie."
Was it only that morning that Lizzie had ridden off to camp on the bus? It seemed like 1,000 years ago.
"Home, Mama," insisted Boots.
Even though she was exhausted, he had a hard time getting her to sleep. Now he could tell by how restless she was that she was having vivid dreams. Probably full of giant cockroaches and bats, he thought. He had no way to tell how much time had passed, an hour, two, but what little noise he'd been able to hear through the curtain had ceased. If he was going to do this thing, he needed to get started. Gregor gently disengaged himself from Boots and stood up. He fumbled in the dark and found the sling Dulcet had given him. Trying to position Boots inside it proved tricky. Finally, he just squeezed his eyes shut and let his other senses work. That was easier. He slid her in and slung the pack on his back. Boots murmured,
"Mama,"
and her head fell against his shoulder. "I'm working on it, baby," he whispered back, and searched the table for the lamp. That was all he was taking, Boots, the pack, and the lamp. He'd need his hands for other things. Gregor groped his way to the curtain and pushed the edge aside. There was enough torchlight from the far hall for him to make out the passage was empty. The Underlanders had not bothered to post guards at his door now that they knew him better. They were making an effort to make him feel like a guest, and anyway, where would he go? Down the river, he thought grimly, wherever that leads. He crept along the hall, taking care to place each of his bare feet silently. Thankfully, Boots slept on. His plan would disintegrate if she woke before he got out of the palace. Their bedroom was conveniently close to the bathroom, and Gregor followed his way to the watery sound. His plan was simple. The river ran under the palace. If he could make his way to the ground floor without losing the sound of water, he should find the place it drained into the river. If the plan was simple, its execution was not. It took Gregor several hours to weave his way down through the palace. The bathrooms were not always near the stairs, and he found himself having to backtrack so he wouldn't lose the sound of rushing water. Twice, he had to duck into rooms and hide when he spotted Underlanders. There weren't many about, but some sort of guards patrolled the palace at night. Finally, the sound of water became stronger, and he made his way to the lowest level of the building. He followed his ears to where the roar was loudest and sneaked through a doorway. For a moment, Gregor almost abandoned his plan. When Dulcet had said, "River," he had pictured the rivers that flowed through New York City. But this Underland River looked like something out of an action-adventure movie. It wasn't terribly wide, but it ran with such speed that the surface was churned into white foam. He couldn't guess its depth, but it had enough power to carry large boulders by as if they were empty soda cans. No wonder the Underlanders didn't bother to post a guard on the dock. The river was more dangerous than any army they could assemble. "But you must be able to travel on it. They have boats," thought Gregor,
noticing half a dozen crafts tied up above the rush of the current. They were made out of some kind of skin stretched over a frame. They reminded him of the canoes at camp.
Camp!
Why couldn't he just be at camp like a normal kid? Trying not to think of the bobbing boulders, he lit his oil lamp from a torch by the dock. On reflection, he took the torch as well. Where he was going, light would be as important as air. He blew out the oil lamp to save fuel. He carefully climbed into one of the boats and checked it out. The torch slid into a holder clearly designed for it.
How do you get this thing down in the water? He wondered.
Two ropes held it aloft. They were attached to a metal wheel that was affixed to the dock.
Well, here goes nothing, Gregor said, and gave the wheel a yank. It gave a loud creak, and the boat fell straight into the river, knocking Gregor on his rear end.
The current swept up the boat like it was a dried leaf. Gregor grasped the sides and hung on as they shot into the darkness. Hearing voices, he managed to look back at the dock for a moment. Two Underlanders were screaming something after him. The river curved, and they vanished from sight. Would they come after him? Of course they would come after him, but he had a head start. How far was it to the waterway? What was the waterway? And once he got there, where did he go next? Gregor would have been more concerned about these questions if he wasn't trying so hard to stay alive. Along with the boulders, he had to dodge the jagged black rocks that jutted out of the water. He found an oar lying along the bottom of the boat and used it to deflect the canoe off the rocks. The temperature of the Underland had felt comfortably cool since he'd arrived, especially after the 90-degree heat of his apartment. But the cold wind whipping up off the water made goosebumps rise on his flesh. Gregor! He thought he'd heard someone call his name. Was it his imagination or no? There it was again. The Underlanders must be closing in on him. The river swerved and suddenly he could see a little better. A large cavern lined with crystals shimmered around him, reflecting back his torchlight. Gregor made out a glittering beach flanking one side of the river up ahead. A tunnel led from the beach into the dark. On impulse, Gregor pushed off a rock and pointed the canoe toward the beach. He paddled desperately with the oar for the shore. Staying on the river was no use. The Underlanders were breathing down his neck. Maybe he had time to pull up on the beach and hide in a tunnel. After they'd passed by, he could wait a few hours and try the river again. The canoe slammed into the beach. Gregor caught himself just before his face hit the boat bottom. Boots jerked partly awake and cried a little, but he soothed her back to sleep with his voice as he struggled to pull his craft across the sand with one hand while carrying the torch with the other.
It's okay, Boots. Shh. Go back to sleep.
Hi, Pat, she murmured, and her head plopped back on his shoulder.
Gregor heard his name in the distance and sped up. He had just reached the mouth of the tunnel when he ran headfirst into something warm and furry. Startled, he staggered back a few paces, dropping the torch. The something stepped out into the dim light. Gregor's knees turned to jelly, and he sunk slowly to the sand. The face of a monstrous rat broke into a smile. Chapter 8
Ah, here you are at last, said the rat idly. By your reek, we expected you ages ago. Look, Fanger, he has brought the pup.
The long nose poked over the rat's shoulder. It had a friend.
What a tidbit she is, said Fanger in a smooth, rich voice. I will allow you the entire boy if I may have the sweetness of the pup to myself, Shed.
It is tempting, but he is more bone than meat, and she is such a morsel, said Shed. I find myself quite torn by your offer. Stand, you boy, and let us better tell your stuffing.
The cockroaches had been freaky, the bats intimidating, but these rats were purely terrifying. Sitting back on their haunches, they were a good 6 feet tall, and their legs,
arms, whatever you called them, bulged with muscle under their gray fur. But the worst part of all was their teeth. 6-inch incisors that protruded out of their whiskered mouths. No, the worst part was that they were clearly planning to eat Gregor and Boots. Some people thought rats didn't eat people, but Gregor knew better. Even the regular-sized rats back home would attack a person if they were helpless. Rats preyed on babies, old people, the weak, the defenseless. There were stories. The homeless man in the alley, a little boy who'd lost 2 fingers. They were too horrible to think about. Gregor slowly got to his feet, retrieving the torch, but keeping it down at his side. He pressed Boots back against the cavern wall. Fanger's nose quivered. This one had fish for supper, mushrooms, grain, and just a bit of leaf. Now that's flavorful, you must admit, Shed. But the pup has gorged on stewed cow and cream, returned Shed, not to mention she is clearly milk-fed herself. Now Gregor knew what all the fuss about bathing had been. If the rats could detect the handful of greens he'd eaten hours earlier, they must have an unbelievable sense of smell. The Underlanders hadn't been rude when they'd wanted him to bathe. They'd been trying to keep him alive. He went from attempting to evade them to wishing desperately that they'd find him. He had to hold the rats off. It would give him time. The expression startled him. Vicus had said killing him would give the roaches no time. By time, did the Underlanders simply mean more life? He brushed off his clothes and tried to adopt the rats' casual banter. "Do I have any say in this?" he asked. To his surprise, Fanger and Shed laughed. "He speaks," said Shed. "What a treat. Usually we get nothing but shrieks and whimpers. Tell us, Overlander, what makes you so brave?" "Oh, I'm not brave," said Gregor. "Bet you can smell that." The rats laughed again.
"True. Your sweat carries much fear, but still you have managed to address us."
"Well, I thought you might like to get to know your meal better," said Gregor.
"I like him, Shed," howled Fanger.
"I like him, too," choked Shed. "The humans are commonly most dreary. Say we may keep him, Fanger."
"Oh, Shed, how is that to be? It would entail much explaining, and besides, all this laughter gives me hunger," said Fanger.
"And me," said Shed, "but you must agree to eat such amusing prey is a great pity."
"A great pity, Shed," said Fanger,
"but without remedy.
Shall we?"
And with that, both rats bared their teeth and moved in on him. Gregor slashed at them with the torch, sending a trail of sparks through the air. He held it in front of him with both hands, like a sword, fully illuminating his face. The rats pulled up short. At first, he thought they were afraid of the flame, but it was something more. They looked stunned.
"Mark you, Shed, his shade," said Fanger in a hushed voice.
"I mark it, Fanger," said Shed quietly. "And he is but a boy. Think you he is?"
"He is not if we kill him," Fanger growled, and lunged for Gregor's throat.
The first bat came in so silently that neither Gregor nor the preoccupied rats saw it. It caught Fanger mid-leap, knocking him off course. Fanger plowed into Shed, and the rats landed in a heap. Instantly, they regained their feet and turned on their assailants. Gregor saw Henry, Marith, and Perdita zigzagging their bats above the rats' heads. Besides avoiding one another in limited space, they had to dodge the wicked claws of the rats. Fanger and Shed could easily leap 10 feet in the air, and the sparkling ceiling of the cavern over the beach was not much higher. The humans began to dive at the rats, wielding swords. Fanger and Shed fought back viciously with claws and teeth. Blood began to stain the beach, but Gregor couldn't tell whose it was.
"Flee!" Henry shouted at Gregor as he whipped past him. "Flee, Overlander!"
Part of him wanted to, badly, but he couldn't. First of all,
He had no idea where to go. His boat was high on the beach, and the tunnel? Well, he'd rather take his chances in the open than in the tunnel if he had to deal with the rats. More important, he knew the Underlanders were only here because of him. He couldn't just run away and leave them to face the rats. But what could he do? At that moment, Shed caught the wing of Marith's bat in his teeth and hung on. The bat struggled to free itself, but Shed held fast. Perdita came in behind Shed, taking off his ear with one stroke of her sword. Shed gave a howl of pain, releasing Marith's bat. But as Perdita pulled out of her dive, Fanger leaped onto her bat, ripping a chunk of fur off its throat and hurling her to the ground. Perdita hit her head on the cavern wall as she landed and was knocked out. Fanger loomed over her and aimed his teeth at her neck. Gregor didn't remember thinking of his next move. It just happened. 1 minute, he was pressed against the wall, and the next, he had jumped forward and thrust his torch into Fanger's face. The rat shrieked and stumbled backward, right into Henry's sword. Fanger's lifeless body fell to the ground, taking the sword with it. Fanger's shriek finally woke Boots, who took one look over Gregor's shoulder and began wailing at the top of her lungs. Her cries echoed off the walls, sending Shed into a frenzy and disorienting the bats. "How fly you, Marith?" yelled Henry. "We can hold," cried Marith, although his bat was spraying blood from its wounded wing. Things didn't look good. Marith's bat was losing control. Henry was unarmed. Perdita was unconscious. Her bat was gasping for air on the ground. Boots was screeching, and Shed was insane with pain and fear. Though bleeding badly, he had lost none of his speed or strength. Marith was trying desperately to keep the rat from Perdita, but he was just one guy. Henry flew interference, but he couldn't get in too close without a sword. Gregor crouched over Perdita, holding the torch. It seemed a fragile defense against the crazed Shed, but he had to do something. Then Shed leaped, catching Marith's bat by the feet. The bat slammed into the wall, and so did Marith. The rat turned on Gregor.
"Now you die!" screamed Shed.
Boots screamed back in terror as Shed lunged at them. Gregor braced himself, but Shed never made it. Instead, the rat let out a gasp and pawed at the blade that jutted through his throat. Gregor caught a glimpse of Luxa's bat, Aurora, flipping upright. He had no idea when she'd arrived. Luxa must have been flying completely upside down when she'd stabbed Shed. Even though Luxa had flattened herself on the bat's back, Aurora barely managed to pull out of the maneuver without scraping her off on the ceiling. Shed slumped back against the cavern wall, but there was no fight left in him. His eyes burned into Gregor's.
"Overlander," he gurgled, "we hunt you to the last rat."
And with that, he died. Gregor had only a moment to catch his breath before Henry landed beside him. Pushing Gregor out onto the beach, he lifted Perdita in his arms and took off yelling, "Scorch the land!" Blood pouring down his face from a gash on his forehead, Marith was already wrenching the swords from Shed and Fanger. He dragged the rats into the river, and it quickly carried their bodies away. His bat shakily regained the use of its wings, and he hurtled onto its back. Marith caught Boots' backpack and hoisted Gregor onto his stomach in front of him. Gregor saw Aurora hook her clawed feet into the fur at the shoulders of Perdita's injured bat. Luxa had at some point retrieved the oil lamp from the boat. As they rose into the air, she smashed it onto the ground. "Drop the torch!" yelled Marith, and Gregor managed to straighten his fingers, releasing it. The last thing he saw as they darted out of the cavern was the beach bursting into flame.
Chapter 9.
Gregor watched the water flash under his eyes as he clung to the bat. For a moment, he felt relieved to have escaped the rats, but the fear of hurtling through the air on a wounded bat quickly overcame him. Boots had her arms clasped so tightly around his neck that he could barely breathe, let alone speak. And what would he say to Marith anyway? "Wow, I'm really sorry about that whole thing back on the beach." He'd had no idea, of course, about the rats. But hadn't the Underlanders tried to warn him? No. They had spoken of danger, but no one had specifically mentioned rats, except the cockroaches.
"Rat bad,"
one had said. And later they had talked about how much the rats would pay to bargain with Luxa. He and Boots could have been sold to the rats. And then what? He felt nauseous and shut his eyes to block out the churning water. The image of the carnage on the beach filled his head, and he decided the view of the water was better. It turned to blackness as the light from the fire diminished. When light flickered off the waves again, he knew they were nearing Regalia. A group of Underlanders waited on the dock. They whisked the unconscious Perdita and her bleeding bat away. They tried to take Marith on a stretcher, but he brushed them off and insisted on helping to carry his bat inside. Gregor sat on the dock, where Marith had shoved him as they'd landed, wishing he could disappear. Boots was quiet now, but he could feel her little muscles were rigid with fear. 15, 20 minutes passed, maybe. He couldn't tell. "Up," someone snarled at him, and he saw Marith glaring down at him. The gash on his forehead was bandaged, the right side of his face bruised and swollen. "Find your feet, Overlander," Marith barked. Had he actually thought this guy was shy a few hours ago? Gregor slowly straightened his stiff legs and stood. Marith tightly tied his hands behind his back. No question about it this time, he was definitely a prisoner. Another guard joined Marith, and they marched Gregor ahead of them. His legs moved numbly. What would they do to him now? He paid no attention to where they were going. He just walked whatever way he was pushed. He had a vague sense of climbing a lot of stairs before he entered a large diamond-shaped room. There was a table in the middle of it. Marith pushed him down on a stool by a roaring fireplace. The two guards stepped back a couple of paces, watching him like hawks. "I'm that dangerous," he thought foggily. Boots began to stir on his back. She tugged on one of his ears. "Home," she pleaded. "Go home, Kiko." Gregor had no answer for her. People were hurrying past the door, talking in excited voices. Some peered in at him, but no one came in. In the warmth of the fire, he realized he was frozen. He was soaked in river water up to his waist and shivering from the wind and the horror of what he'd witnessed, of what he'd taken part in. Boots was in better condition. Her backpack seemed to be waterproof, and she was pressed up against him. Still, her toes felt like ice when they brushed his arm. Fatigue washed over Gregor, and he wished he could lie down, just lie down and fall asleep and wake up in his bed where he could see the car lights flashing across the walls. But he had given up thinking this was a dream. What had happened to the Underlanders? Perdita, her wounded bat, and Marith's. If they died, it would be his fault. He wouldn't even try to argue that. Just then, Luxa appeared, burning white with fury. She crossed the room and struck him on the face. His head snapped to the side, and Boots let out a cry.
"No hitting," she squeaked. "No, no, no hitting."
She shook her tiny index finger at Luxa. Hitting was absolutely forbidden in Gregor's house, and it had only taken Boots a few timeouts to realize it. Apparently, it wasn't acceptable among the Underlanders either, because Gregor heard Vicus's voice ring out sharply from the doorway, "Luxa."
Looking like she'd love to slap him again, Luxa stalked the mantel and glared into the fire.
"For shame, Luxa," Vicus said, crossing to her.
She turned on him, spitting venom. "Two flyers are down, and we cannot awaken Perdita because the Overlander must escape. Strike him? I say we throw him into the Deadland and let him take his chances," shouted Luxa.
"Be that as it may, Luxa, this is not seemly," said Vicus. But Gregor could see the news had upset him.
"Both rats are dead?" he asked.
"Dead and in the river," said Luxa. "We scorched the land."
"This matter of we, you and I shall take up later," said Vicus severely. "The council is not pleased."
"I care not what pleases the council," muttered Luxa. But she avoided Vicus's gaze.
So she wasn't supposed to be there, thought Gregor. She's in trouble too. He wished he could enjoy the moment, but he was too racked with worry, guilt, and exhaustion to care. Besides, Luxa had saved his life taking out Shed. He owed her one, he guessed, but he was still stinging from the slap, so he didn't bring it up.
"No hitting," said Boots again, and Vicus turned to them.
Like Luxa, Gregor was unable to meet his eyes.
"What did the Overlander, Luxa? Fight or flee?" asked Vicus.
"Henry says he fought," Luxa admitted grudgingly, "but without skill or knowledge of weapons." Gregor felt like saying, "Hey, all I had was a stupid torch." But why bother?
"Then he has much courage," said Vicus.
"Courage without caution makes for early death, or so you tell me daily," said Luxa.
"So I tell you, and do you hear?" said Vicus, raising his eyebrows. "You hear not as he hears not. You are both very young for deafness. Unleash his hands and leave us," he said to the guards.
Gregor felt a blade cut through the ropes on his wrists. He rubbed the marks, trying to restore circulation to his hands. His cheek throbbed, but he wouldn't give Luxa the satisfaction of seeing him touch it. Boots reached over his shoulder and touched the creases on his wrists.
"Ow!" she whimpered. "Ow!"
"I'm okay, Boots," he said, but she just shook her head.
"Gather us here," said Vicus, sitting at the table.
Neither Gregor nor Luxa moved.
"Gather us here, for we must discuss," said Vicus, slapping his hands on the stone surface.
This time they both took their seats as far from each other as possible. Gregor pulled Boots up over his head and out of the backpack. She settled on his lap, wrapping Gregor's arms tightly around her and looking at Vicus and Luxa with large, solemn eyes.
"I guess after tonight, Boots won't think the whole world is her friend," thought Gregor. She had to find out sometime, but it still made him sad.
Vicus began, "Gregor the Overlander, there is much you do not understand. You do not speak, but your face speaks for you. You are worried. You are angered. You believe you were right to flee those who kept you against your will, but feel sorely that we have suffered in your saving. We told you not of the rats, yet Luxa blames you for our losses. We seem to be your enemy, and yet we gave you time."
Gregor didn't answer. He thought that pretty much summed things up, except for the fact that Luxa had hit him. Vicus read his mind.
"Luxa should not have struck you, but your fight invited horrible death to those she loved. This is greatly felt by her, as both her parents were killed by rats."
Luxa gasped. "That is not his affair." She looked so distressed that Gregor almost objected as well. Whatever she'd done to him, this wasn't his business.
"But I make it so, Luxa, as I have cause to believe that Gregor may himself lack a father," continued Vicus.
Now it was Gregor's turn to look shocked. "How do you know that?"
"I do not know for sure, I only guess.
Tell me, Gregor the Overlander. Recognize you this?
Vicus reached in his cloak and pulled something out. It was a metal ring. Several keys dangled from it, but it was the roughly braided loop of red, black, and blue leather that made Gregor's heart stop. He had woven it himself during crafts class at the very same summer camp that Lizzie was at now. You could make three things, a bracelet, a bookmark, or a keychain. Gregor had picked the keychain. His father never went anywhere without it.
Part 2. The Quest. Chapter 10. When Gregor's heart started up again, it beat so hard he thought it might break through his chest. His hand reached out on its own, his fingers grasping for the keychain. Where'd you get that?
I told you other Overlanders have fallen. Some years ago, we rescued one very like you in face and feature. I cannot recall the exact date, said Vicus, placing the keychain in Gregor's hand.
2 years, 7 months, and 13 days ago, thought Gregor.
Aloud, he said, It belongs to my dad.
Waves of happiness washed over him as he ran his fingers over the worn leather braid and the metal snap that allowed you to attach it to your belt loop. Memories flashed through his mind. His dad fanning out the keys to find the one to open the front door. His dad jingling the keys in front of Lizzie in her stroller. His dad, on a picnic blanket in Central Park, using a key to pry open a container of potato salad.
Your father?
Lux's eyes widened, and a strange expression crossed her face.
Vicus, you do not think he...
I do not know, Luxa. But the signs are strong, said Vicus. My mind has been on little else since he arrived.
Luxa turned to Gregor, her violet eyes quizzical.
What? What was her problem now?
Your father, like you, was desperate to return home. With much difficulty, we persuaded him to stay some weeks, but the strain proved too great, and one night, also like you, he slipped away, said Vicus. The rats reached him before we did. Gregor smashed into reality, and the joy drained out of him.
Of course. There were no other living Overlanders in Regalia. Vicus had told him that in the stadium. His dad had tried to get home and had met up with the same fate Gregor had, only the Underlanders hadn't been there to save him. He swallowed the lump in his throat.
He's dead, then.
So we assumed. But then came rumor that the rats had kept him living, said Vicus. Our spies confirm this regularly.
He's alive?
Asked Gregor, feeling hope rush back through him.
But why? Why didn't they kill him?
We know not why with certainty, but I have suspicions.
Your father was a man of science, was he not? Asked Vicus.
Yeah, he teaches science, said Gregor. He couldn't make sense of what Vicus was saying. Did the rats want his dad to teach chemistry?
In our conversations, it was clear he understood the workings of nature, said Vicus, of trapped lightning, of fire, of powders that explode.
Gregor was beginning to catch his drift.
Look, if you think my dad's making guns or bombs for the rats, you can forget it. He would never do that.
It is hard to imagine what any of us would do in the caves of the rats, said Vicus gently. To keep sanity must be a struggle. To keep honor... a Herculean feat. I am not judging your father, only seeking to explain why he survives so long.
The rats fight well in close range, but if we attack from afar, they have no recourse but to run. Of all things, they wish a way to kill us at a distance, said Luxa. She didn't seem to be accusing his father either, and she didn't seem mad at him anymore. Gregor wished she'd stop staring at him.
My wife Solovet has a different theory, said Vikas, brightening a little. She believes the rats want your father to make them a thumb.
A thumb? Asked Gregor. Boots held up her thumb to show him.
Yeah, little girl, I know what a thumb is, he said, smiling down at her.
Rats have no thumbs, and therefore cannot do many things that we can. They cannot make tools or weapons. They are masters of destruction, but creation evades them, said Vikas.
Be glad, Overlander. If they believe your father can be useful, it is all that will give him time, said Luxa sadly.
Did you meet my dad, too? He asked.
No,
she replied.
I was too young for such meetings.
Luxa was still concerned with her dolls, then, said Vikas.
Gregor tried hard to imagine Luxa with a doll, and couldn't.
My parents met him and spoke him well, said Luxa.
Her parents.
She'd still had parents then.
Gregor wondered about how the rats had killed them, but knew he'd never ask.
Luxa speaks true.
At present, the rats are our bitter enemies.
If you meet a rat outside the walls of Regalia, you have two choices, to fight or be killed. Only the hope of a great advantage would keep a human alive in their paws, especially an Overlander, said Vikas.
I don't see why they hate us so much, said Gregor. He thought of Shed's burning eyes, his last words.
Overlander, we hunt you to the last rat!
Maybe they knew how people in the Overland tried to trap, poison, and kill off all the rats above ground, except the ones they used in lab experiments.
Vikas and Luxa exchanged a look.
We must tell him, Luxa. He must know what he faces, said Vikas.
Do you really think it is he? She said.
Who?
He who? Said Gregor.
He had a bad feeling about where this conversation was going.
Vikas rose from the table.
Come, he said,
and headed out the door. Gregor got up, willing his stiff arms to carry Boots. He and Luxa reached the door at the same time and stopped.
After you, he said.
She glanced at him sideways and followed Vikas. The halls were lined with Underlanders who watched them pass in silence and then broke into whispers. They did not have far to go before Vikas stopped at a polished wooden door. Gregor realized it was the first wooden thing he'd seen in the Underland. What had Vikas said about something being as rare as trees? For trees, you needed lots of light. So how would they grow here?
Vikas pulled out a key and opened the door. He took a torch from a holder in the hall and led the way in.
Gregor stepped into a room that seemed to be an empty stone cube. On every surface were carvings, not just the walls, but the floor and ceiling, too. These weren't the frolicking animals he'd seen elsewhere in Regalia. These were words. Tiny words that must have taken forever to chisel out.
A, B, C, said Boots,
which is what she always said when she saw letters.
A, B, C, D,
she added for emphasis.
These are the prophecies of Bartholomew of Sandwich, said Vikas. Once we sealed the gates, he devoted the rest of his life to recording them.
I bet he did, thought Gregor. It sounded like just the kind of thing crazy old Sandwich would do. Drag a bunch of people underground and then lock himself in a room and chip out more crazy stuff on the walls.
So, what do you mean, prophecies? Asked Gregor, although he knew what prophecies were.
They were predictions of what would happen in the future. Most religions had them, and his grandma loved a book of them by a guy named Nostra something. To hear her talk, the future was pretty depressing.
Sandwich was a visionary, said Vikas. He foretold many things that have happened to our people.
And a bunch that haven't? Asked Gregor, trying to sound innocent. He hadn't ruled out prophecies entirely, but he was skeptical about anything Sandwich came up with. Besides, even if someone told you something that would happen in the future, what could you do about it?
Some we have not yet unraveled, admitted Vicus.
He foretold my parents' end, said Luxa sorrowfully, running her fingers over part of the wall. There was no mystery in that. Vicus put her arms around her and looked at the wall.
No, he agreed softly. That was as clear as water.
Gregor felt awful for about the 10th time that night. From now on, whatever he thought, he would try to talk about the prophecies with respect.
But there is one that hangs most heavily over our heads. It is called the Prophecy of Grey, for we know not whether it be fair or foul, said Vicus. We do know that it was to Sandwich the most sacred and maddening of his visions, for he could never see the outcome, although it came to him many times.
Vicus gestured to a small oil lamp that illuminated a panel of the wall. It was the only light in the room besides the torch. Maybe they kept it burning constantly.
Will you read? Asked Vicus.
And Gregor approached the panel. The prophecy was written like a poem in four parts. Some of the lettering was odd, but he could make it out.
A, B, C, said Boots, touching the letters.
Gregor began to read. Beware, Underlanders. Time hangs by a thread. The hunters are hunted. White water runs red. The gnawers will strike to extinguish the rest. The hope of the hopeless resides in a quest. An overland warrior, a son of the sun, may bring us back light. He may bring us back none. But gather your neighbors and follow his call, or rats will most surely devour us all. Two over, two under of royal descent, two flyers, two crawlers, two spinners ascent, one gnawer beside and one lost up ahead, and eight will be left when we count up the dead. The last who will die must decide where he stands. The fate of the eight is contained in his hands. So bid him take care, bid him look where he leaps, as life may be death, and death life again reaps. Gregor finished the poem and didn't know quite what to say. He blurted out, "What's that mean?" Vicus shook his head.
No one knows for certain.
It tells of a dark time when the future of our people is undecided. It calls for a journey, not just of humans, but of many creatures, which may lead either to salvation or ruin. The journey will be led by an overlander. Yeah, well, I got that part. This warrior guy, said Gregor.
You asked why the rats hate overlanders so deeply. It is because they know one will be the warrior of the prophecy, said Vicus.
Oh, I see, said Gregor. So, when's he coming?
Vicus fixed his eyes on Gregor. I believe he is already here.